Food and Finance Policy Division order. The clerk will note the roll. Representative Lickert, will you approve the minutes from the February 20th and 2020 meeting?
I will, Mr. Chair. I move the approval of the minutes.
Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Same sign, motion carries. Thank you. First up is Minnesota Department of Agriculture update on meat processing and meat inspectors. Dr. Nicole Meester, did I get that right? From the Dairy and Meat Inspection Division. Welcome, Dr.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I am not Dr. Kneeser. My name is Peter Chesset, Director of Government Affairs at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Just briefly, I bring you greetings from Commissioner Peterson. He is out at NASDA in D.C. and regrets that he can't be here. But just on this topic, he wanted me to share that, you know, over the interim, we traveled the four corners of the state, and we heard a lot about this issue. It is one of Commissioner Peterson's top priorities moving forward. And we are currently having internal conversations at the department about ways to address this issue. And also Assistant Commissioner Patrice Bailey plans on doing extensive outreach this upcoming interim, similar to the outreach that we conducted with the emerging farmers. And at this point, I'll just pass it over to my colleague, Dr. Nicole Kneeser.
Thank you. Welcome to committee, and please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Dr. Nicole Kneeser, and I'm the Director of Dairy and Meat Inspection Division at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. This morning, I'm just going to give you a very brief overview of the meat inspection program and meat inspection in Minnesota, our processing and slaughter aspects of that we do, and hopefully set the stage for Ariel, who will be following me. So. I think a lot of this information you will have heard last session, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. But at the department, we manage the Minnesota Meat and Poultry Inspection Program, which includes a state equal to inspection program, which means that we have inspection activities that are equal to that of the USDA Food Safety Inspection Service. This means that the plants that we inspect at can wholesale their products within the state of Minnesota, but not across the border. Into other states. We have to perform these inspection activities the same as essentially USDA, although we call it equal to because we do change up a lot of our administrative procedures and hopefully are a bit more user-friendly for some of our smaller plants. But it does entail what's called continuous inspection, meaning we have to be present during all of slaughter activities and then at least daily during processing at each plant that is under inspection. We also conduct inspections of custom exempt processors, which are sort of your traditional local butcher shops that do not for sale meat for farmers or direct marketing activities. We are 50% funded by USDA FSIS. you can see what our budget looked like for the last fiscal year here. Our trends are the industry is changing a lot. A lot of our activities and some of our plants that are joining us are more non-traditional, based in meat products that aren't our traditional hams and bacons that are a lot of our local plants make, and rather they might be halal carcasses or Hmong sausage or other products, but still fall under the jurisdiction of meat inspection. So our inspections are also required for our plants that are under the program to wholesale their products. So if they're going to wholesale to grocery stores or convenience stores or any sort of outlet like that, they have to have inspection. And then for farmers, if they're going to direct market products through farmers markets or retail stores or any sort of retail outlet, they do need to have inspection as well. I do have on here a chart of our actual numbers of inspections for federal fiscal year 2018. We operate on the federal fiscal year for a lot of our tracking due to the federal budget. And we do about 9,400 inspections a year. That counts slaughter, processing, and custom exempt. We do that with about 17 and a half FTEs. So the vast majority of our staff are field inspectors or supervisors. We have two field supervisors, one of which is a veterinarian that does work in the plants when there's issues with pathology and food safety issues, one program manager, myself as a director, and then we have about 1.5 FTEs of administrative staff. As I mentioned, we do slaughter inspection, which means we're there during the entire time. We look at every animal before and after they are slaughtered. We do processing where we're checking food safety inspection or food safety plans, checking cooking temperatures and other parameters for sanitation. And then we do a lot of sampling just to verify that the plant systems are working for food safety. And this is the inspection numbers for fiscal 19, which is, again, about 9,400 inspections. So we're pretty stable. Inspection numbers don't necessarily tell the whole story. One slaughter inspection could mean an inspector's there for 8 hours. So a processing inspection may mean the inspector's there for 30 minutes. And so there's a lot of variability in there. We try to be a more user-friendly version of USDA. USDA is a really big organization, and if you're a small plant going into USDA trying to get an inspector, you have a lot of layers to get to someone in authority if you have a question or you need an interpretation or you're having an issue. So we try really hard to be a more user-friendly version, be responsive and accessible. We don't have a very big hierarchy, and so if there's an issue, you can get to the top pretty quickly. We want to remove barriers. For example, language. Some of our plants, plant owners don't speak English very well, so we work with translators to try to get in there to try to help operators comply, even if they don't have a good mastery of English. We do a lot of education and outreach, especially when more complex regulations come along. And the regulations are complex for meat inspection. There's no doubt about that. So, and then we do try to be a stepping stone for establishments so that if they grow, which we want them to grow, they can get going under our inspection program and hopefully grow to the point where they need USDA to move their product across state lines. Some of the challenges that our inspection program and industry are facing. One of them is poultry processing, and I think you'll hear a little bit more about that today. We used to actually be the state in the U.S. with the most poultry plants under equal to inspection with 6, which is a very small number, but we actually had the most of any state. We basically now have 2 plants under inspection, and one of those, well, actually both of those, don't take birds from outside. They only slaughter birds of their own. We may have one plant that will be sticking with us through the summer. We're not quite sure yet. That does take birds from farms that are not their own, but this is a really big issue. Farmers need their birds to be inspected to sell them, and there's no plants to do that inspection. You know, we have inspectors out there that can do the inspection, but there are not plants. One issue is food safety related that they encounter. Producing salmonella campylobacter negative chickens is really hard in a small processing facility where you have a very manual process. A lot of people are handling the birds. There's a lot of opportunities for cross-contamination. And they need very good quality controls, and sometimes that's very hard to implement, particularly if you don't have a great stable labor force, if you are struggling with trying to get seasonal workers. Poultry processing and slaughter is not the most desirable of jobs, and so a lot of our processors have struggled mightily to get employees even just to clean equipment or, you know, just to work regular shifts. Also, the smaller plants don't have 40-hour work weeks. You know, they may process 2 days a week. Well, find people to work 2 days a week in a slaughter plant is really challenging. So we're seeing some of those issues with poultry processing, so we're looking for ways to support and actively trying to work with folks who want to do poultry processing to try to help them get going. As you've probably heard before, there's always a balance between our inspectors' availability and inspection needs or demands. That need typically exceeds our availability to provide inspection. It does vary depending upon the season. So if we're not in a poultry season, we may have more availability. It depends on the economics of the economy, just in general, you know, how well meat products are being sold, or just, you know, the demand for meat. So that's always an issue that we're trying to balance out those needs. And then the diverse and changing industries. So you'll hear a lot more about this today, but meat and poultry products are definitely staples in the diets of many in the immigrant and ethnic communities. And our live animal markets, which I know a few of you have been out to, they are regulated as custom exempt. Those products can't be sold to grocery stores, but they're very popular for sort of direct marketing. They're extremely popular. You know, we have thousands of animals going through those markets every week here in Minnesota. The variety of products that we regulate and the types of products are changing, and so the food safety issues that we work with are a little different that way. Our establishment owners, the profiles of them are changing. Like I mentioned before, you know, we have owners that don't speak English well, and so we're trying to work with them to try to do translation. And then there's big markets that are basically unfilled. The halal market in particular, we see that there's large opportunities for marketing those kind of products, and not very many people or plants that are able to fill those. And that's for a number of products, but particularly goats. So I know you'll hear a little bit more about that. And that's all I have this morning, just to set the stage for you. Does anyone have any questions for me?
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, food safety is important, and there's some real concerns about how we handle our food. But have you heard from processors that the current regulatory environment is creating some problems for businesses, or regarding closures or limiting new businesses to come forward because of the regulatory requirements?
Dr. Neisser.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I guess we haven't had any more recent examples, but I guess I will say on the poultry side of things, it's a good example of sort of trying to find the balance between food safety and regulatory oversight of that. For example, there are requirements that poultry needs to be produced at a certain level of salmonella and campylobacter. Now, just for background, salmonella and campylobacter are a natural part of a poultry or a bird's gastrointestinal tract. It's a natural part of the process. It's just present in the normal scheme of things. And so our poultry plants are expected to try their best to produce birds that are free of salmonella and campylobacter, or at least have as little as possible on those raw carcasses, knowing, though, that those products are still raw when they're going out, and we expect the consumers to cook them. However, there's a lot of pressure to bring those products down to zero, or call salmonella and campylobacter an adulterant, which means if it had it, it would have to be thrown away. Well, the truth is it's nearly impossible to do that in a small plant without an extreme amount of quality control and extreme sort of amount of regulation, and we still have that intervention of the customer cooking the product in there. And so there's some expectations in sort of trying to turn down some of those things that maybe, depending on your perspective, are not logical. But that's a good example, and that's one thing that our poultry plants really do struggle with, is the managing that process. And it's a food safety thing, but also, you know, managing the expectations of the customer to consumers. So,
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, part of the challenge in handling meat, raw meat, anyway, is for our consumer to understand how to handle whether it's raw chicken or pork or beef or lamb or whatever. I'm just thinking out loud that, you know, we don't teach some of those things, you know, home ec. Sorry. What is it called? Life science now? I'm old, yes. Yes, but, and I grew up on a farm, so we learned, we didn't do any butchering, but, my grandmother did. I remember the chickens, but it just that understanding of how to handle, and we're not doing much education, so that becomes a concern on the other end of purchasing that. So I just, yeah, it concerns me that we do too much regulation. Is there another type of butchering process that they actually come out to the, like a beef farm, and actually do the butchering through a mobile unit? Can't even think of where I've seen that, but can you talk about that a little bit?
Dr. Nisha.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative. There are mobile slaughter units that can go from farm to farm. We don't have any under equal to inspection in Minnesota. I believe there may be one, Levi can tell me, one under USDA inspection in Minnesota. So it is possible even to have an inspector follow along from farm to farm to farm. And there are several custom exempt ones where they're just going from farm to farm to slaughter for the farmer. Definitely, yes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gill.
Thank you. Then it isn't going to a regular market, though. It is going directly to a purchaser. The animal is going from the purchaser to their freezer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, if it's the custom exempt, yes, usually that's the case, unless the animal has been sold ahead of time to someone. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Doctor, building off a little bit of what Representative Keel was talking about, do we run into any challenges with individuals having difficulty navigating through the permitting process, trying to be able to start up a new facility? You spoke a little bit to the specialty market and some language barriers. Within the Department of Agriculture, are there resources to help people to navigate through that permitting process?
Mr. Chair, Representative. Yes, first off, in terms of language barrier, those kind of barriers, we actually, because we are federally funded as well, we do provide all the translation services for those folks if they need them. So we actually work pretty closely with individuals who are trying to get under equal to inspection, and essentially we assign them to a consultant's level person to walk them through the steps. We do have some resources available. We're actually working on revising those here this summer, but resources available to kind of walk them through the step of getting an equal to what we call grant of inspection. A lot of times some of those barriers are more local, not necessarily state, so it might be their city or their county trying to get septic or water permitting, depending on what their zoning is. A lot of times they have to get that ironed out before they even get to us, because all our only requirements are that you're in compliance with them. And so we'll usually try to work, get them back to the right places to get in compliance with those first. And then once it comes to us again, we assign them to a person, so they're always working with the same person to walk through that process. Honestly, a lot of the delays are typically on the establishment end. Usually when someone contacts us, we usually tell them 3 to 6 months, but it depends on them, because they need to get their labels or their HACCP plan written or those kinds of things. And normally we're waiting for them, and sometimes, you know, they're doing it on their schedule depending on their business model and that kind of thing. So oftentimes it's closer to 2 years. But we can push them through pretty fast if they're ready. So,
thank you.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm glad to hear, Doctor, that the department is at least looking at ways that you can encourage more processes to get into the business, because it does seem to be a niche where we could help our smaller farmers and whomever trying to get into the business. But Representative Keel mentioned the regulation things, and I had a fellow back home that wanted to get into the business of processing chickens for his neighbors. And tying into the regulation part of it, the expense just shocked him as he got into it, with certain type of concrete flooring, walls, number of sinks, and water testing and things like that. And yeah, we all want the safety, but the cost can be a prohibitive aspect to some. But just to, could you clarify, and I know poultry is kind of a different animal than slaughtering hogs or beef, but define again the equal to, or do you have to have USDA inspections if you're working with chickens or poultry?
Dr. Neeser.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, the poultry regulations are quite complicated, and there are exemptions that allow farmers to slaughter their own birds on their own farm and sell them without inspection. So they can slaughter 1,000, 5,000, depending on where they're marketing to, without inspection. Typically, we see once a farmer, you know, gets past that like 5,000-ish range, they're starting to go to outlets where that they need inspection, whether it's equal to or USDA. But they can do that if it's their own birds. The catch usually is if they want to compile birds from other farmers, that they will then need to have inspection for that process. So,
Representative Anderson.
Again, at that point, if they're taking in outside birds, would that be the equal to or the USDA inspection?
Dr. Neeser.
Mr. Chair and Representative, it depends on what their final market is. If they're going to sell those birds across state lines, they would require USDA inspection. If they're going to stay within Minnesota, they could do that under equal to inspection. So a lot of that depends on their location. So, you know, if they're located in Moorhead, they're probably going to need to go to USDA. But if they're, you know, here in the metro, there's a big market and they can usually get by, or they can, you know, work with equal to usually.
Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr., I'll start off first with a comment. Having lived 4 years outside of the United States in a more emerging economy, I would say thank you for the work that you do and providing our food in a safe and reliable way. Living with regulation from a business perspective is sometimes difficult, but from a consumer perspective, oh my gosh, it's just so nice to know that our food supply is safe. So I'll start with that. My question really is about the custom exempt processors. And as their facilities age, do you see any transition issues like we are seeing with farms in transitioning?
Dr. Neeser.
Mr. Chair and Representative. Yes, definitely. So there's challenges that happen, particularly if a establishment owner hasn't been real proactive in updating their facility over time. We do see that some of the slaughter establishments that were built many years ago, according to sort of there used to be like this USDA guidebook for building a slaughter establishment, those establishments have held up very, very well, and they're still, most of them are in very good shape. And so if they have, if they built it well to begin with and they've maintained it over time, usually we can manage those transitions fairly well. With meat inspection, our facility requirements are very standards based and not specific to like a material type or flooring type or something. And so really, you know, it has to be smooth, easily cleanable, impermeable to moisture. And so if they've got a concrete wall and it meets those standards, then they're good. Where we see problems is if the concrete are starting to crumble and those kinds of things, and then those kinds of fixes are often fairly cost prohibitive. We have seen a few of those that have tried to transition, that the buildings are just so old that it's very hard for someone new to come in and invest the amount of money that they would need to do that. But we have seen a number of actually brand new custom exempt plants be built that are very nice. And I think sometimes they're doing that cost benefit analysis of building a new plant or trying to fix up the old one. So we've seen a little bit of both, but we've seen a lot of successful transitions too. So,
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe you covered this earlier, but in looking at the issue of the government regulation is one thing, but that's generally looked at as the floor. So the certifying agencies, where there are markets for either restaurants or so looking at production, they may be looking at different things of certification. So the certifying entities are different than certifying agencies. And did you look at that particular thing? I know in poultry, questions like are the chickens debeaked, or are they, how much time are they allowed outside? What's the ratio of chickens to space? how egg production, how are the eggs handled? So those things may be a different expense. They are not a government regulation, but they are requirements to meet the market, the consumer market, for retail. And maybe can you highlight that, if you're seeing those issues as a difficulty or a barrier to coming in, and how do you address that barrier?
Dr. Neeser.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen. We are seeing a lot more interest in making special claims on products. So whether it is, grass-fed beef or naturally raised, or, you know, there's a myriad of different kinds of claims that can be made. I think that we've seen that perhaps the barrier to that is that usually if they're going to make that claim on their label, they need to substantiate the claim. So whatever that claim is that they're making, they need to provide us with some sort of support to say, if you're saying your this meat is coming from grass fed, then you need to show us or tell us that it really is grass fed. And the challenges with that is that there's not a lot of common standards. And so when you're talking about, access to the outdoors, is like, well, what does that really mean? And, you know, how much access to the outdoors? Did they get to go outside for an hour a day, or are they just outside all the time? And so there's a lot of differences, interpretation for the standards. However, I think that most operators are finding those as strong niche markets that they're able to fill, and that's a big selling point that a lot of operators and farmers are able to take advantage of at this point in time. We're seeing a lot of labels come through with special claims like that.
Thank you. And a follow-up is that some of those certifying entities require an upfront dues or a fee, which may be substantial, or they require a fee and a percent of the sale, or they require a percent of the sale. So are there any places there where there could be, I think we have a precedent of paying for organic certification from the state. Is there any potential there for paying a upfront fee for certification that's not organic, but that is something for the processors on production? I'm not talking government regulation here. I'm talking about the fee for entrance into a market.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I guess I don't have the knowledge of what the fee structures are for some of those certifying agencies to comment on that. As you know, we do the inspection, and basically we're looking at a label and asking someone to substantiate that. We often are not looking for a certain certification. We're just looking for substantiation of meeting whatever you said on that label. And so we're not necessarily saying, with the exception of organic, because that is a regulatory standard now, we're not looking for that. However, if they are claiming a certain statement or a certain thing that goes with a certain certifying agency, then we would require that. So, but I do think that we see most of the products we see haven't gone that route with a certain certifying agency in terms of the meat and poultry right now. Certainly in the future, I think as that market and that becomes bigger, that definitely will become a bigger issue.
Thank you. Dr. Neeser, thank you for coming to the committee today, and we appreciate the report.
Thank you.
Next up is the University of Minnesota report on kosher and halal meat. Ann Dibsetter, Ariel Kagan, and Marianne Abiner. Welcome to the committee. Please state your names for the record as you get ready to go and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ann Dibsetter, and I thank you for the opportunity to be here with you today to talk about the halal and kosher meat market report in Minnesota. I'm the executive director of the Southwest Regional Sustainable Development Partnership. We're part of University of Minnesota Extension, and I serve Southwest Minnesota And there are five regions of the Regional Sustainable Development Partnerships. You might hear me refer to that as RSDP. The Regional Sustainable Development Partnerships were actually formed right here at the Minnesota Legislature in 1997 with the vision that rural communities can work in partnership with the University of Minnesota to support community-driven projects in natural resources, in sustainable agriculture and local food systems, in resilient communities, and in clean energy. Our project leader for the Halal and Kosher Meat Market Project is Dr. Kathy Drager, and she's the statewide director of RSDP. She regrets that she's unable to be here with us today, so I'm happy to be able to fill in as one member of the research team that worked on the report. One of the unique strengths of RSDP is that we can bring a diverse team of university experts to engage around an issue, while at the same time having really deep roots in community and community partners who care deeply about the questions at hand. So the work we're talking about today is one example of that kind of work. It's interdisciplinary, high-quality work that can benefit all Minnesotans. The Halal and Kosher Meat Market Report was funded and called for by Minnesota Department of Agriculture in collaboration and cooperation with the Agricultural Research Utilization Research Institute, AURI. And the scope was for a market assessment of halal and kosher meats in Minnesota. Both halal and kosher are faith practices related to foods that are permissible to eat. Halal traditionally practiced by Muslim people, and kosher traditionally practiced by Jewish people. And Ariel will share more details about those practices in a moment. So RSDP and Extension answered the call for a market study and came forward with a research team that included our wonderful partners at the Sustainable Farming Association, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and community members, as well as a university team of university and extension folks in community economics, in small farms, in health and nutrition, livestock systems, and supply chain analysis. The photo you can see here of the project team was taken at a farm outside Silver Lake, Minnesota in McLeod County. The farm is owned by Mr. Mohammed Gabani, who operates a non-farm slaughtering facility that meets some of the demand for fresh goat meat among Somali community members in that area. Mr. Gabani is shown here in the center of the photograph, and he made it clear that the demand for fresh Minnesota halal meat exceeds what he's able to supply. To develop the report, the team did almost 40 interviews, a focus group with Somali consumers, and a survey. So for instance, as part of the research, I had the opportunity to talk with community members and a community leader in Pipestone County, where there's investor interest in exploring halal goat processing. I also talked with a farmer and entrepreneur who's operating in Nobles County and Rock County. I'm hearing from people in southwest Minnesota who are raising goats and sheep and then shipping animals to Illinois and Colorado to be slaughtered because they don't have access to slaughtering plants, not just in Minnesota, but in surrounding states as well. Also in my region, I've worked with the Somali community in Wilmer, for whom having access to a reliable supply of halal meat, in particular goat meat, is a priority. And further, there are also opportunities for the Somali community members to explore livestock production and processing on that side of the equation as well. So this topic, in this case, halal goat meat in particular, presents opportunities for increasing access to culturally accessible and acceptable foods, and at the same time, opportunities for economic potential for farmers and entrepreneurs. For instance, one of the findings of the report is that the demand for halal goats is perhaps in the hundreds of thousands of goats per year in Minnesota, while the goat census in Minnesota is around 25,000 goats. And that includes 4-H goats, dairy goats, buckthorn-eating goats, not just meat goats. So that demand is currently being met by frozen meat imported primarily from Australia at a price point that's actually quite low for reasons that are described in more detail in the report that you have access to. The greatest opportunity for Minnesota-grown products seems to be of a high-quality, fresh, halal meat, likely at a higher price point if it's to meet the needs of the farmers and the processors in our state. So people in my region in southwest Minnesota are echoing what's widely recognized. Minnesota is seen as a producer and provider of high quality agricultural products. The demand is here. Meanwhile, there's not yet a stable market for goats in Minnesota at this time. The livestock auction system isn't robust when it comes to the goat market, and prices are really widely variable. So there's quite a lot of complexity here and quite a lot of opportunity to this market, and that's explored at greater length in the report. I'm going to turn it over to Ariel to share some more specifics.
Well, Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Great, thank you. Is this close enough for the microphone? Okay, great. So my name is Ariel Kagan. I work at MDA in the marketing division, and I was the lead content author for this report. So as Anne did mention, both kosher and halal are faith practices for Judaism and Islam, respectively. And one thing that is important for this committee is to just recognize that because of the First Amendment, our ability to or option to create policy around these practices is limited, and that's the rightfully so. But we do still have laws in the books that protect the labeling around kosher and halal. There's just no place for the government to define those terms. And in terms of the definitions, the report does go into some depth about those definitions. There's a lot of variety. These are diverse communities, and there's been hundreds or thousands of years to develop what these expectations are around kosher and halal standards, how they're applied, and what they look like, and certainly a lot of debate within the communities about the rules surrounding these practices. So the key things here is that kosher and halal can both be applied to many different things, so how you set up your household, your finances, pharmaceuticals, other things. In this context, when we talk about kosher and halal, we're just speaking about meat, and that's a very narrow term, an application for the term, but just so that you know that these are wider issues. And I think the other big piece is that kosher and halal are similar, but they're not the same, and certainly the communities that are looking for these labels in the marketplace are not the same, and they have different expectations and different needs. So I think when we're talking about what is kosher, and again, I don't want to go too deeply into the details because these are things that people spend their entire lives trying to figure out exactly what kosher meat means. But there are sort of more rigid definitions around the labeling and certification. More consumers are looking for kosher labels on meat than in the halal market. For kosher, we're talking about specific animals that have cloven hooves and chew their cud. Poultry is also kosher. Pork, horses, camel are not animals that can be kosher. And we're primarily speaking about the front half of the animal, though that's not always true depending on the community that you're working with. In the case of kosher, the slaughter must be performed by a shochet, which is someone who's been trained in the kosher rules and methods for slaughter. And stunning is never allowed in kosher practices before slaughter. After slaughter, the animal must be drained of blood by salting and soaking, so there's an additional step after the slaughter for kosher practices. For halal, there's, again, a wide variety of definitions and expectations for what this looks like. There's not as much of a robust certifying practice within the halal market at this point, though that is growing, and we have a number of certifying bodies in the United States. The largest one is Ifanco, which is based in Chicago, and their label is the first one on the list there on your slide. So when we're talking about halal, there are a number of criteria as well, depending on the community that you're working with or the certifying body that is being engaged. And those can include things like the animal must be facing Mecca, the slaughterer needs to be a practicing Muslim, although in some cases that person can be another person of faith, whether Christian or Jew, or just someone who has some faith background. Other animals cannot witness the slaughter. And in halal, the expectation is that it's a live slaughter without stunning, although in some certifying agencies, stunning is allowed if it's a reversible stun. And in countries where we're importing from, specifically New Zealand, all animals are stunned before slaughter, and that's something that not all halal consumers may agree with, and so is an issue for consumer protection and what they are expecting versus what they're getting. Processing is obviously a big topic and what we just heard a lot about. Here in Minnesota, the MDA does have a process for applying to have a ritual slaughter practice. The USDA also has a form that you fill out to apply for this. It's referred to as a ritual exemption, but it's not an exemption to the humane handling laws. Live slaughter is one of the two methods for humane slaughter in US law. And so it's important to know that this is not something that removes those expectations from the process. The process is slower in many cases because of a live slaughter, and it may require specialized equipment. So there are a number of sort of holding boxes that have been developed for ensuring the humane handling of animals. And for kosher practices, those additional equipment pieces for the salting and soaking of the meat is also something that would add on to the needs of a processor. In the kosher market in Minnesota, we're talking about a relatively small population of Jewish people who are looking for kosher meat. And of course, not all Jewish people are looking for kosher meat in their diet. And not all people who are looking for kosher meat are Jewish. So I think many people are familiar with looking for kosher hot dogs when they go to buy hot dogs. There's just a certain consumer attribute that goes along with that. And most of our kosher meat that is being provided in the Twin Cities is coming from a few large-scale processors in the U.S. We actually do have one here in Minnesota, in western Minnesota, but a lot of them are also in Iowa and New York and on the East Coast. The highest demand that we found in our research was for chicken and beef within this market, and there was a need for additional attributes related to the meat beyond the kosher certification. Consumers are looking for organic standards, animal and labor welfare options, and the quality and price of the meat was also something that wasn't up to many people's standards. We did hear from a number of people we interviewed that they had either given up eating meat or had dropped their kosher expectations when shopping for meat and were instead looking for things like an organic label. So that was surprising. In the halal market, it's a really diverse segment. So we think of our largest halal consumer group in Minnesota is the Somali community, but we also have a number of halal consumers who are Middle Eastern or Asian, Southeast Asian, and they all have different dietary preferences and different expectations for the kind of meat that they want to buy. So the highest demand within the Somali population that we found was for goat, beef, and some chicken, and most of the goat meat is being imported from Australia and New Zealand. It's frozen, it's coming in large, sort of large cut format, and is available in stores throughout the Twin Cities and throughout Minnesota. You can go and see product of Australia in many stores throughout Minnesota. The need for fresh meat is something that we heard universally from everyone we talked to. And a preference for local and sustainable was also something that was expressed to us. I think also the opportunity for value-add halal meat is a really great place for Minnesotans to look at how to create new businesses. Things like halal burritos and pizzas are things that are missing in the market currently. So the big takeaways, and the report is long, I've heard from many people, and but it's detailed, and I think it's worth reading because this is a really complicated market and very complex relationship-based products and expectations. So there's no one-size-fits-all to either the kosher or halal market. In Minnesota, it's specific to the traditions and expectations of the communities that we're working with. There is, though, what we heard, an unmet demand for fresh and sustainable meats, both in the kosher and halal markets. And of course, we really can't talk about any of this without looking at the shortage of processing for small to mid-sized meat in the state, and especially for small to mid-sized animals. So we just heard about the issue with poultry processing, but we also heard from a number of processors that goats are just not worth the time. They're just, it's not enough meat for the fixed costs that go along with processing. And that's a huge problem. We also know that there's a lack of a developed market for sheep and goats. So farmers who want to start serving this market, there's not a very good way to sell their goats, whether it's at auction or one-to-one sales. There's very high price volatility within those markets. So you don't know what to expect when you get there, if you're going to sell your goat for $80 or $120. And that makes it really hard to do business planning, of course. The key underlying part of all of this, though, of course, is that food can be a part of community and economic development. And I was last here in front of this committee talking about the Emerging Farmers Report, and this is deeply linked to those things. If we're thinking about what our food system is going to look like in the future, we're talking about new Americans, new Minnesotans, young farmers, different community traditions, and I think it's really exciting to think about what this means in the context of our farm economy and our culture in Minnesota. So I'm really happy to pass it off to Marianne now to speak a little bit more to that side of it.
Welcome. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Marianne Abdennour. I am very glad to be here with you guys today. I thank you for this opportunity to share my, on behalf of Hope Community and the Land Stewardship Project, who I currently work with, and also one of my partners that's here, Saad Abdi, on a project that we call HELOP, where we've been doing research around halal and for our community, what does that look like in the last 2 years. I'm currently the lead farmer and policy organizer with a program called Food, Land, and Community, focusing around building food sovereignty within the Phillips neighborhood in South Minneapolis. I facilitate our growing spaces. We have three different gardens where we engage with over 200 community members from the ages of 6 to 84, currently learning how to grow food within the current climate that is Minnesota. I grew up in East Africa, so snow is still very new to me. I've been here for 15 years, and every season I'm like, oh, it's happening again. it's real. And so what our focus in that and with this report, I want to first thank the Department of Agriculture and the Extension programs that have contributed their efforts into bringing this forth, this report forth. Because as I know, you guys have worked with a report that's 20 years old. Our community is 25 years old. So I don't feel like you had a lot of content to understand what a halal market would look like and what types of food that I might be wanting from a market that exists today. As one of the largest agricultural states in this country, I believe that's very important for us to have a report that reflects the community, whether it's very new or has been here for generations. In my reading through this report and understanding, one of the things that I find is that although it does cover an extensiveness and it is looking at a multi-diverse community in a micro levels, that it is also, because it's a market analysis, it's not able to capture the cultural preferences and the some of the disparities and barriers that exist within communities like this. And as the representatives of a committee of such for the agriculture, I believe there is a level of responsibility to understand that as well. And so I'm not one of the researchers or one of the reviewers on this report. I am a community member that is very much interested in the outcome of a market like this. So I'll go through some of those steps, and then I also would like to offer up an opportunity to further maybe explain what, as a practicing Muslim, halal means to me in all the different components and later in the questions parts. Like I said, this report offers us a stepping stool for the halal and kosher market assessment, and that it offers also a lens of a possibility of a market for our community at large, whether it's our farmers in rural Minnesota or most of our consumers that are in urban Minneapolis today. What I find that this report is not able to cover for the limitation that it is a market analysis is the halal process. One of the main things is that halal process starts at the life of the animal. Some scholars might argue it starts at the life of the human that's consuming this animal later on. The diversity, it also doesn't cover the diverse community of voices, whether it's looking at the specifically consumers, there are 40 community members who have been interviewed in this, but also what does this mean for entrepreneurs? What does it mean for the scholars that currently exist? We have some of the best scholars in the Northern Hemisphere that live in Minnesota, and how does their opinion get taken into this, something that's very rooted in a religious practice. I think for cultural practices, we are, as we ought to, adapt to the societies that we're in, and coming to the West and coming to the United States might mean that we have to give up some of those practices in order to adjust to the society that's already here, because that's what neighborly is. You can argue that's what Minnesota nice is as well, but that's what neighborly is. However, I think this gives us an opportunity to further explore that and then ask for exactly what our community needs so that the tradition of the halal is honored in the process, as the kosher would be, hopefully. It also doesn't, the halal, process that it's beyond meat. In one of the largest agricultural state, I feel like our food is also very critically important. How are we eating also our vegetables? What is our relationship to land? Because at the root of it, in my understanding and my 14 years of studying these laws, is that halalness is connected to our relationship to land, and it builds from that. So anything that comes in connection with that, whether it's our meats and our food, is also supported by that. The other thing that I'm looking at is going through the religious ritual process of producing something that's halal. And hearing the people before us who have spoken on the restrictions and the shortages of processing facilities, how can a facility that is for halal be made available to community members and to farmers so that they're able to be in a better position to be able to produce and sell this meat that is coming through here? How is the halal meat process requirements education offered to community members that not only have the barrier of not being in the dominant population, but also have the barrier of not having access to the English or facilities that can actually provide the languages? Because until 5 years ago, I did not know the halal goat meat that I was eating or any halal meat that I was eating was coming from Australia or New Zealand. That's what brought me to this work was 5 years ago, researching that and learning that and learning further that it's not USDA regulated. There is some exemptions on that. And I don't know how long this meat has been frozen and has been traveling. And it's being sold to me here in Minnesota. It is also how do we look at the butchering process, that how do you evaluate and how do you create certification process whether somebody has faith or not, right? Like how does a governing body regulate somebody's faith? Like that's, I really don't want you to do that. Mm-hmm. And so how do we talk about that and create a conversation? How do we look at the consumption process? What is the narrative around overproducing or even looking at the opportunity for export to neighboring states or even outside of the country? Because currently New Zealand and Australia export all the way to Saudi Arabia, to Indonesia, and so forth. There is an opportunity there for our farmers, but what does that mean and how does that get regulated? And I also, you know, our conversation earlier, there is the point of food safety. And what does that look like with poultry that is being looked at halal, or with beef that's being looked at halal, or with goat and sheep that's being looked at halal? And then beyond food safety in that sense of whether we're controlling bacteria and germs that are traveling to our homes and how we cook our foods, how does food safety look at in food deserts, in urban settings and rural settings with communities that are there currently? So with that being said, I think one of the things I would ask from the Department of Agriculture with the research team and with this representing body here today is that looking at, you know, how the further reviewing of this report and looking at where are some of the opportunities to add or to further clarify or to keep as is with community members that are coming from different backgrounds, developing a list of priorities for the Department of Agriculture to focus on implementation strategies across Minnesota in rural and urban. Currently, our largest Muslim population is in Minneapolis, primarily that being the Somali community, which is the second largest urban population outside of the capital of Somalia, Mogadishu. And then develop and create a halal certification process in order to honor the halal and kosher religious grounding of these practices. How's there more opportunities? When there's one, you know, a few facilities that exist or one facility that's in Western Minnesota for kosher processing certification, there isn't one for halal meats. And the ones that are currently here, I feel like have been developed with that the need to adapt to a current society or the way things are done in order to get a portion of what we need. But this is an opportunity for us to fully understand what halal is or what kosher is, and to develop a process that fits for people so that every Minnesotan has access to the foods that they need. And I think I say that with the lens and the understanding that I want to really, in order to create a positive future food, that we need to be thinking one, thinking of requiring and honoring food systems or food traditions while also developing new ways of thinking and working together, while looking at diets, cultures, technology, environment, and policy, and where are their intersects. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Ab. Hope I didn't butcher your name. Abinur?
Abdinur.
Abinur, thank you for your testimony. Questions? Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you all for your work. Ms. Kagan, I was interested as you brought up the First Amendment earlier in the presentation. And I recognize that the state cannot establish religion. We need to stay neutral towards multiple faith traditions. We also can't prevent the free exercise of religion, which is religious practice, which is what we're talking about here. So I'm curious if you could just say a little bit more about where the department feels like some of the legal boundaries are, and if there's some open questions that you're trying to sort through in this process right now as well.
Ms. Kagan.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lippert, it's a balance. I think that there's a lot of role for the department to partner with these communities and also to provide technical assistance and funding as needed. Historically, there have been a number of states that have passed laws that have then been challenged in either the state or federal Supreme Courts based on what those definitions and expectations of these practices are. So the laws on our books currently leave the definition entirely up to rabbinical or Islamic authorities. And then the role of the state is just to enforce that. So for example, if you have a kosher claim, we have specific laws about where on the freezer case you need to say that and how large the text needs to be and things like that. But there's no rules about what kosher means from the state. Okay. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Representative Book.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to thank all three of the presenters. I don't know, you may or may not be surprised to know that this report is rattling around in Malaysia right now. I happened to hear a week or so ago, this came out and I got a hold of it digitally. And same time, my son, who works over in Malaysia right now, but he's lived both in the Middle East and in Asia a number of times over the years. He works at the embassy there in Malaysia, and so there was this USDA trade rep stumbling around the embassy, looking at markets and stuff, and noted right away that from the beef perspective, literally just a huge amount of beef is imported at Malaysia from Australia, and so this gentleman was trying to figure out how to find a halal-related American-produced product in Nebraska, and he bumped into my son, and so he got him aside and said, "Well, you ought to be looking in Minnesota because we've certainly got the community in the background for many years in this area." So, and again, this is. Maybe way down the road, but there is a huge market over there. Australia controls it. I've been to Australia myself. I know we do a better job of raising animals, not to put a fellow cattle people down, there is a market there for beef. I remember when he moved back from the Middle East, he was looking for goat meat and had. Here and immediately found it, but you had to know what you're looking for because that's a normal red meat that's consumed in other parts of the world by much more. So it looks like we got two issues. We don't have the livestock capacity and processing here by a factor of four. We're missing we should not have to be importing that type of product from overseas in a place like Minnesota. And then the other one is that Malaysia is looking at, they've got a huge market there for that particular, particularly for the beef. So, but again, and so I emailed this to him and he chased the guy down and they're still working on that. And I also contacted Commissioner Peterson. And so I know his folks are working on this, but this is definitely a growing area, and we've got talent here, I think, in Minnesota from an export standpoint, if we could get things lined up, because we are very competitive throughout Asia with American-produced beef and a variety of other meats. And so, but this is a very specialized area, and I don't remember Malaysia's about 90% Muslim. So from standpoint of it, it's a huge market there. But anyway, this, yeah, he's now there's several copies of this floating around the embassy in Kuala Lumpur right now, and my son is a, you know, somewhat of a farm boy, and so he was a little disappointed when they were looking for this type of information and expertise in Nebraska instead of in Minnesota. But anyway, I want to thank you again, and if I can help at all, I know my son and the group there in Malaysia are in contact with the commissioner and his folks, but there's certainly some area there that, you know, within the United States, I think we've clearly got the expertise and the talent here, and we're even trying to solve our own product, you know, we don't have enough product here right now available locally. I mean, we even have to search for lamb coming from New Zealand and Australia, which we shouldn't have to do. But anyway, again, I want you, yeah, just so you know, this thing is floating around over there in Asia right now.
Thank you for the report. And all the real chairs here, so we can.
Anybody have any additional questions? Seeing none, then thank you for the testimony.
Thank you.
So now we are moving on to Representative Petersburg. He's in the audience. There he is. So I think Representative Anderson, you have a motion?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 3458 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Capital Investment and Finance.
Thank you. And there is an author's amendment. So again, Representative Anderson, and that should be in the packet. So people know what that is. Would you like to move the amendment?
Madam Chair, I move the A20-0650 amendment.
All right. Thank you for that. Any questions, discussion on that amendment? Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of the A20-0650 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay? All right. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So welcome to the committee, Representative Petersburg. Please present your bill and introduce your witnesses. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee, and thank you for hearing this bill. The reason for the amendment was, like sometimes happens, I knew exactly what I meant, but it didn't always come out that way. And so this is to clarify the fact that this was not intended to be a budget bill for anybody's budget, but actually an investment from capital investment. And I thank Ms. Conley for identifying that for me and Mr. Sullivan for working on that as well. So this bill really is about Farm America, which briefly about that is, because I know you have another bill yet to come, was created as one of three learning centers many decades ago by the legislature, and it's in down in Waseca. And Waseca has a great opportunity for involvement in agriculture, because not only do we have Farm America, we also have the Southern Minnesota Research Outreach Center and Experiment Farm through the University of Minnesota, and we also have an AURI research and development facility there as well. So we are kind of a hot spot for agricultural development and growth. And this is a great opportunity. Farm America has a great potential to be more than it is. And I have with me Jessica Rollins, who is at the helm of Farm America, who will kind of explore some of the visions she has to make it the potential and why it's a great investment for Minnesota and Minnesota's capital investment program. So with that, Madam Chair, I will turn it over to Jessica Rollins.
Thank you. Ms. Rollins, welcome to the committee. Just state your name and then begin your testimony.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jessica Rollins, the Executive Director at Farm America. And I'll be as quick as I can, even though you made it sound like I could say lots of stuff, because we are wonderful. We're an awesome organization. So I'm the Executive Director, like I said, at Farm America. We're just a couple miles west of Waseca off of Highway 14, and we have 360 acres of opportunity. I'm going to present a quick background of Farm America and our programs and then our request for funds. So, like Representative Petersburg said, we were created in 1978 by the Minnesota State Legislature as a location to promote and celebrate the story, past, present, and future of agriculture in Minnesota. We're a 501c3 nonprofit governed by a board of 15 volunteer elected directors. And our mission is to connect people with the evolving story of agriculture. And we do that in several ways. We do that through sensory experiences like our historic farm tours, our interactive activities, our whole family educational programming, which includes field trips and farm camps. Nearly 12,000 folks visit Farm America each year. And with our social media presence, that allows us to engage with thousands more. Our annual budget is $370,000. Excuse me for one moment. And we carefully spend that on operations and maintenance of our aging historic buildings, programs, services, and administration. We're very grateful for the financial support that we currently receive from Minnesota taxpayers, which we receive through the governor's budget. That's $115,000 each year, making up a third of our annual budget. Grants, donations, membership, admission, and site rental make up another third. And then we have 220 acres of Farm America's 360 acres that we have designated to crop research to further advance farmer sustainability. And what that means is the research is led by agricultural partners, and the sales from those crops we then use as the last third of our budget. So at Farm America, we have done an excellent job of creating and celebrating the history of agriculture and telling that story through hands-on programming. And in the last 4 years since I've been there, we've really started to implement new programming and field trips that explore outside of that historic piece. We move away from the historic old red barn to really look at what agriculture is today. One of the programs that we do, we joined forces with Junior Achievement, and we started an Ag Career Exploration Day for 7th and 8th graders where they come to Farm America and explore what their personal interests are and how those might align with careers in agriculture in the future. And it can be a financial struggle at times to do what we do, but we know that we should do more and we can do more, and that is why we're embarking on a $1 million capital campaign, phase one of two parts. We want consumers and future consumers to be able to make those personal connections to agriculture. We want them to understand what it is that's happening on the farm and what's happening in the grocery store and what's happening around them, and that it affects them every single day. So as a result of this capital campaign, we'll be able to offer year-round programming, nearly double our attendance, and help visitors to understand that story of today's agriculture and the future. 82% of the private businesses and commodity groups and Minnesota residents who we interviewed during our feasibility study were in support of this capital campaign. And since mid-December, we have raised just shy of $200,000 of our $1 million goal. So I'm here today to ask you guys to also support this worthy cause and an organization that was founded by your predecessors 41 years ago. Specifically, that $250,000 request could be spent on site improvements, help maintain and upgrade our buildings that help tell that story of agriculture. Funds can help us build the hands-on exhibits to transform an underutilized square footage space that we have right now and turn it into the Ag Around You Discovery Center. I believe there was a handout passed to you folks. I see some of you. Yes. And on the backside of that, it does show some renderings of what we're hoping to do in that space, and I'll touch on that in just a second as well. We'll use curriculum that's already been developed by Minnesota Ag in the Classroom, FFA, Farm Bureau, and really implement that more into our programs that we're offering and be able to offer more programs, more field trips, year-round education, like I said, and day camps, and really dive deeper into what that story of today's agriculture is. And so you'll see on the backside there, then we're going to renovate our historic feed mill into an educational and inviting classroom space, because we do need more classroom space for the kids who come through. And you'll see the non-functional space in our visitor center on the top of that handout is going to be transformed into an ADA-compliant Ag Around You Discovery Center to help people explore how agriculture impacts their everyday lives in their homes. So, for 41 years, Farm America's staff and board have been helping consumers celebrate the history of agriculture, and now more than ever, consumers want to know where their food is coming from and how, what that connection that they have to agriculture is. So I ask you, please help Farm America, Minnesota's Agricultural Interpretive Center, to be that source that people look to when they want to explore, discover, and connect with agriculture around them.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Cleburne.
Thank you. And this is a newbie question, and maybe the House research people can answer it for me. I understand a regional asset, and I understand the program, and I don't have any problem with the bill itself. So I want to be really clear about that. The expanded agricultural literacy programming, can that be paid for with capital investment dollars? I'm just asking because I don't know the answer.
Mr. Sullivan.
Madam Chair and Representative Cleavorn, I don't believe it could be paid for from bonding proceeds, capital investment proceeds, but the bill is for a general fund grant. So I think although the literacy programming might not be tied directly to site improvements, I think it would be eligible for general fund support.
Okay, I was just clarifying. Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just asking to clarify because when I first saw this, I thought legacy or even history society money. So, I mean, that's why I was asking the question.
Thank you. Do you have any other testifiers? Anyone else in the audience who wanted to speak in support or in opposition? No, seeing none.
I thank you, Madam Chair. If I could just close. So
yes, Representative Petersburg. Absolutely.
I want to thank you for this. And legacy is one of the things that we are still possibility of pursuing that. We just thank you for listening to the bill. And I would like to invite you all down to Waseca and to Farm America. Anytime you can come and see it, it's a great adventure. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, I renew my motion that House File 3458, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee of Capital Investment Finance.
Thank you. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and you will be going next to another committee. Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you. So now we turn to Representative Lippert. And he has some testifiers who will be joining him at the table. So Representative Lippert, welcome to the committee, and I think you want to
thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I move that House File 3420 be laid over for future consideration.
All right, so please go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So I'm pleased to be working on this legislation with Reynaldo Hazat-Merakim and the Regenerative Alliance and the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs as well. Ray, he's been doing great work in getting Latino farmers started in agriculture in southeast Minnesota by inviting them into a regenerative poultry system that includes integration of perennial crops like hazelnuts. Latino farmers in southeast Minnesota are currently producing 250,000 chickens. And as we heard in prior presentations, processing is a major obstacle for them. So what we have here is support for planning for processing processing plant industrial park, but a particular model for processing. This proposed processing facility would allow for the processing of 1.2 million chickens and create the potential for processing for 10 million chickens in the future as well. So this processing facility will be unique. It's challenging for a standalone poultry processing to be sustainable right now. So the proposal here is for a processing plant where poultry will be the anchor, but processing for perennial and regenerative crops such as hazelnuts, kernza, and other small grains will be a part of the park as well. So this collaborative relationship will lower costs for the processors and ultimately for the farmers too. Though this project is being spearheaded by the Latino farming community, the processing facility will serve farmers of all ethnic backgrounds. Also, when this processing facility comes to fruition, it will be the first of its kind in the nation. So I'll turn it over to Rahe to say more from here.
Yes, welcome to the committee. And what we'll do is we'll hear the testimony before we take any questions. So go ahead, state your name, and then begin your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Reynaldo Hazat Marroquin. I live in Northfield, Minnesota. I'm from Guatemala. I'm an agronomist and have a degree in business management out of Augsburg University and a minor in communications and a lifetime of experience with feather animals and other animals. Since we were skinning the goats earlier, I figured maybe we can get to pluck some chickens now. Dr. Nikki Neeser was very clear about this challenge with poultry, and we have communicated back and forth for the last 10 years with the Inspections Division at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and we have been literally, you know, weaving our way around this incredible challenge. It seems it is clear to us that in order to break through some of these emerging markets, and also for farmers who are emerging to break through, we need that middle of the ground infrastructure. Now, I've witnessed in the last 10 years plants in all over the country, from mobile processing facilities to plants in Iowa, and our own processor right now, which is based out of Utica, Minnesota, you know, go from hand to mouth, continuously from hand to mouth, and at the same time charging way more than a chicken is worth in terms of its processing value. Now, having looked closer into the challenges, it is clear that this cannot be resolved by just addressing the poultry processing. In fact, the most important challenge for those processors that are trying to make it is actually securing and supporting the labor properly. And I think Dr. Nikenizer addressed that to a small extent. The important thing to understand is that this needs to be part of an integrated strategy, one that looks at not only the poultry processing, but also further processing of that poultry. Right now, even if we can process up to 250,000 chickens a year, we really can't move them beyond, say, whole chickens. And whole chickens are the tiniest part of the market out there. Most of the chicken is sold, cut up, you know, and repackaged. So the way to approach this is really to look at the multiple layers within the poultry supply chain and then link that to the other associated enterprises. And in our case, we're talking about 14 different enterprise sectors that we have designed into a fully integrated regenerative design. Now, what that means is that we get to capture value out of different channels rather than just trying to make it on poultry. Especially, we want to set up in this light industrial park we're proposing a checkered board of connected dots. So, for example, the perennial cropping systems that we are now deploying more formally are going to need processing very soon. The grain supply needs processing as well. So we got the grain growers that are starting to line up. That grain needs to be processed into either feed for the poultry or food, you know, in terms of flours and other things. That brings us into being able to partner with food-grade grain processors in the same space. Once you put all of this together, and again, we don't have time for all of the components to be laid out the way we need to lay them out once you put some investment into this and we are able to actually hire the expertise and lay this out in a concept. The idea is to then aggregate these values and especially create a place where we can have, you know, Somali, Spanish, and English speaker employment offices so that we can actually train the people for the whole park and be able to manage the different needs for labor. So somebody may need someone for half a day, for example, in the poultry processing, because we don't need as much labor in the afternoon, but the other partner in the other side of the park needs that person for the other half of the, that employee for the other half of the day. Now, that would become a problem for employees, yet if we put that through an employment office that takes care of all of that, it simplifies and secures not only the livelihoods of those individuals, but also their employment stability. Just to give you an example of what the concept is, yes, we're going to anchor this with poultry because at the Alliance we have engineered a system that has high market demand. We can fetch really good prices. We have over 100 farmers in southeastern Minnesota that have been producing already. We want to consolidate that to be able to do all of that. Not only do we need to think holistically about how the economic development infrastructure, it's taxpaying based, the cities that are actually interested in this, but also how to deal with those perennial problems, most of that with the labor stability, which is not possible unless we coalesce and bring this together. That's the concept we want to put forward.
Thank you. We have another testifier.
Stu or Felipe?
So Mr. Yaskas?
Yes.
Please state your name correctly, and then sorry about that.
No problem. Well, good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Felipe Yescas. I am the legislative and policy director for the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs. I am here in full support of House File 3420. Latino farmers currently comprise less than 1% of the farming community in the state. However, as Representative Lippert mentioned, in 2017 alone, they generated over $210 million in revenue. So small but mighty, I guess. Mm-hmm. Now, innovative projects like this one that Rinaldo was describing will ensure that all local and emerging farmers continue to thrive in their own communities in order to move to that next level of production. And I know that I've had many conversations with a lot of you in this room, and I am grateful for those conversations and for your support. So I'm just keeping it brief, but I just want to urge all members of the committee to support House File 3420, and I look forward to further partnership. Thank you.
Thank you. And next we have Stu Lurie.
Thank you, Chair Poppy and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sue Lurie, and I'm the Government Relations Director for Minnesota Farmers Union. And on behalf of Minnesota Farmers Union, eager and happy to support this project and the planning money that Representative Lippert has brought forward. You know, to take a step back and talk about what we've heard in the committee today, but meat processing is one of the top three issues that I hear from Minnesota Farmers Union members across the state and that they bring to me. And it's not just, you know, emerging farmers or folks who are new to farming, but also folks who are experiencing transition in their operation due to economic pressure or generational transition. They're looking at small-scale livestock as a way to add more revenue to their operation and diversify their income streams. So I think this is an innovative project, and from everything that I understand and when I talk to folks and members in Northfield, it's a community in Northeast Minnesota is a community that's ready for this kind of investment, and we're eager to support it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lurie. Anyone else in the audience who wanted to testify? I don't see any others, so we're going to turn to questions. I think Representative Miller has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of quick questions. So the first question, Representative Lippert, is to you, is or maybe the Chair, Madam Chair, where is this funding planning on coming from? Is there a general funds budget that's going to be moving forward, or what are the plans on this?
From my perspective, Representative Miller, we would anticipate if there's a supplemental budget that we want to be prepared to have different ideas, innovative things in place to be able to put into that budget.
Thanks. Not a trick question about the budget. I'm not one of those. I just really wanted to know, because that leads into more of a statement, Madam Chair, Representative Lippert. Good or bad, I volunteered for the Agri-Grant program scoring. Okay, and so I've gotten to know those grants really well over the last couple of weeks, and everything you just described here sounds like a very robust and very good agri grant application. So I'm wondering if you've pursued that, or if that's, because we know that money is there. Have you pursued that as a viable option to do this study?
So I don't know, Representative Lippert, you'd like to take that?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. That hasn't been a part of the conversation to this point, but we're willing to explore all options.
Okay. And then one final question, Madam Chair.
Representative Miller.
Okay. I wish you had an easier name to pronounce. Is it okay if I just call you Rinaldo? Is that okay? Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair Rinaldo. This sounds like a great program. I'm just wondering in the industry, if you have spoken or met with or worked with probably most specific to Chicken and Egg Association, because I think that they would be a very good partner in this. Have you met with them and discussed your plans? And if you have, what does that look like?
Mr. Haslett-Merrifin.
Thank you.
Very good, by the way.
No, I have not. We have been focusing mostly on networking with other communities that are actually facing the same troubles. Primarily, we have been, not able, because there is a lot of integration. You probably, if I may go into a little bit, on the industry, the poultry industry is one of the most locked in, vertically integrated systems. It's impossible to break into that supply chain. So by definition, as a business strategy, we had to pursue building an alternative supply chain. Now, the options are not very good because the niche markets are really not enough to support, or were not enough back when we started. That has changed. At this point, the market has grown enough that we are getting sufficient demand from an alternative supply system, an alternative market, so that we can actually justify starting these very small projects. But if you want to advocate for us and there is capital in the traditional poultry system that they may want to put in this direction on an alternative system, we definitely are willing to work with everyone. The challenge is that, you know, as a good business person, I wouldn't want to invest in a system that is going to compete with me. So I'm just stating the obvious. And so that has kind of kept us a little bit at the same time that we understand that we are really nobody in the context of the industrial system. I mean, the industrial system, if you think of it, we consume 20 chickens per capita in this country. 5% of that, which is what we have been calculating, is around 450 to 500 million chickens a year. It's so huge that our projects really are not economically viable for traditional investors. And so that brings us to this space where we figured, you know, we need to collectively figure out how to start building that supply chain, that alternative supply chain. But we definitely want to work with, you know, even General Mills. We have been having conversations with them, you know, brands that are already established and so on. So far, no success. And we suspect it's just business interest at this point.
Thank you. Thank you. We have a few more questions. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Lippert, how would this proposal affect Longchen Slaughterhouse in South St. Paul, which does a lot of business with different communities?
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hansen. I'll turn over to Rahe for that since he may have more direct experience.
Are you talking about the livestock processor? I mean, the live livestock, because they do a lot of live processing. So we are not intending to do live processing, custom processing the way they do. Basically, what Longcheng does is they have live animals. People come and buy them live, and then they bring them over, and then they process it themselves. They help them, but they are not, they are outside of the regulations because of that. That's not our intention. Our intention is purely to consolidate the production for many hundreds of farmers in the Southeast region, bring those to the traditional supply chain with hopefully state equal to or USDA inspected right away because our markets are outside of the state too, and then move that product through the traditional supply chains, not necessarily moving and targeting the ethnic market itself.
Right, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And one of my favorite snacks is chicken wings. So, anyway. this is a question for the bill author. According to your language, line 1.8, 1.9, this funding, if it's approved, is for planning and designing this plant. So my question is, if you get this funding, what's next? Is there capital lined up for construction or will you need additional state funding to help with the actual construction? But because this is pretty well earmarked just for planning and designing the structure.
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative for the question. I think Rahe will be better equipped to answer that as well.
Yes, American.
Thank you. Sorry. I'm not familiar with the rules. I'm sorry if I violate them here and then. We have been at this for a decade now, and we have built quite a robust system of entrepreneurs and potential investors behind our system. Right at this moment, in fact, we're looking at what is called program-related investments from some of the funders that have helped us develop and engineer this system. They're very interested in the success of this because what they need is exactly that concept. Without the concept, we really can't even present the proposals. and the engineers that we need and the professionals that we need engaged to be able to put this together are not cheap. So, I mean, to us, and this is a small investment in the larger context of the proposal, our feeling is that the actual park may be need about $20 million worth of investment. Hopefully there is some state support, but we are not completely relying on that. We are already making contacts with the Southeastern Minnesota region. Part of this funding would go into organizing regional business meetings. I was part of what is called the Southern Minnesota Regional Competitiveness Project back in 2010, and Representative Rod Hamilton was very familiar with that. That process established that agriculture is the second most important sector for economic development. I promised back then to the Southern Minnesota Initiative Foundation that we will have a differentiated brand in, you know, a few years later. We do now. We call it Tree Ranch Chicken and Tree Ranch Eggs because of the way we raise them. That brand has been gaining momentum, and we have stayed in touch with all of those EDAs across the state, in the Southern Minnesota region. So we have built an ecosystem that allows us to bring a concept like this and shop for those kinds of investments, including interest, current interest from the city of Northfield, the EDA in Northfield, and also Albert Lea. So it's moving along. We just can't move it farther right now until we actually have a good, solid foundation.
Thank you. Representative Blasiewicz. Nope, she's off the... Okay, so seeing no other questions, then Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I renew my motion to that House File 3420 be laid over for future consideration.
All right, thank you. So House File 3420 is laid over for future consideration, and we see nothing else before the committee, so the meeting is adjourned.